Welcome back. It's the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast that focuses on watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. In episode 97, we discuss El Clasico getting its lowest rating in years, our thoughts about the European Super League and what it would do for the TV industry, has Turner Sports turned a corner with their Champions League coverage, Netflix scores a new soccer documentary, and we have a bunch of letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Kartik Krishnire. Now, Kartik, I know in terms of your regular work week, usually it's like probably 90% soccer and then 10% politics. This past week with the midterm elections, if I had a guess, it's probably like 80% politics and 20% soccer. Are you still alive and still kicking after this week?
Yeah, it's been about 80-85% politics and the rest being soccer, yes. But unfortunately, the soccer part got infringed by blame SI for this, Sports Interactive, the release of Football Manager. Which, by the way, the Football Manager game this year is more detailed. There are more bells and whistles in it. It takes a little bit of getting used to, but experience Football Manager players will probably are probably right now just geeking out on it as I speak. Right. And I still haven't gotten really the chance to geek out on it because of the election. But Football Manager 2019 is out, and that cut into my soccer time.
Understandably so, Kartik. I'm sure it's once you get addicted to that game, it's nonstop. So,
in fact, I should just point this out. I don't get much sleep in the days leading up to an election, and definitely not election night, because the day after the election. Because for the listeners' consumption, I'm a Democrat in Florida, and the Democrats always lose close elections in Florida. I was busier Wednesday than I had been Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, even busier than Election Day. Football Manager as the release from election stuff actually was a bad thing for me this Election Day, because I'm getting very little sleep as it stands. And Football Manager is so addictive that what would be 3 or 4 hours of sleep, which isn't good enough anyway, became 1 or 2 hours. Thank you, Sports Interactive.
Yeah, the timing was not good at all. It's probably worst possible timing.
Yeah, usually Football Manager is released
November,
late November.
Right.
Yeah, early.
Right.
Yeah, so it was earlier this year, and that messed me up.
Yep. Well, not me. I didn't get FM 19, so I watched a ton of soccer this past week. Out of all the games I saw, if I had to pick out my favorite, it's actually a draw. It would have been between Wolves and Spurs, which was an absolutely sensational second half. Really, Wolves put Spurs to the test, and it ended up being a 3-2 win for Spurs. But it could have easily been a 3-3 tie or a 4-3 win for Wolves. They had chances. They had one goal that should have been allowed, that was disallowed. Just a really great performance by Wolverhampton Wanderers in front of a really passionate home support, as always, at the Molyneux. The second game, which was the tie for the best game of the week for me, was Eibar against Alaves in the Basque Derby. And this was a game that was played on Sunday morning. I think it was like a 6:30 kickoff. It was one that was on beIN Sports Connect. I don't think it was even on beIN Sports, the actual TV channel. And I watched it. It was a great atmosphere. It's a small ground, but the quality of football was incredible. Just really good football, playing the ball on the ground, beautiful passing, just a back and forth, really competitive match. And I really enjoyed it. Just kind of the best of La Liga there, in with two teams that normally you wouldn't expect it to be such a good game. But just the quality of football was good indeed. Kartik, I know you've been busy, and I know you didn't get the chance to watch a lot of soccer from this past week. Was there anything that stood out? And it doesn't necessarily have to be a game, if it was any kind of, I don't know, highlights or analysis.
Two games, actually. A tie. The second half of the Freiburg match at the Allianz against Bayern. I thought Bayern looked very poor in the first half. Second half, they opened up a little bit. Serge Gnabry got a goal. They were passing the ball well, quicker passing. But Freiburg was very good for much of this match and got a late equalizer. So I thought that was a pretty exciting match. And then I would agree with you on the Wolves the Wolves-Spurs match. The thing about this match that was so complicated for me was Spurs playing on the break versus a team that has what you would think would be kind of superior personnel being able to manage the match differently. They jumped out to a 3-0 lead, but much of that was on the counterattack, taking advantage of mental lapses from Wolves. Wolves continue to be the one side in England outside of Man City and Chelsea now, with Jorginho and the team and Hazard playing in a freer role, that make you want to watch the Premier League. La Liga, you mentioned the Eibar match. You mentioned the Basque Derby. I have to say, you watch any La Liga match, and again, it's personal preferences, Chris, and there's a legion of Premier League fans who are going to come out and lynch me after the statement, but you watch any La Liga match, any random La Liga match, and the quality of actual passing football and technical football is higher than any Premier League match, unless it's Manchester City playing Chelsea or Wolves playing Chelsea. I mean, there's only three or four teams in the Premier League that can play at that level technically. Now, we know there's maybe greater pace and greater more dynamic pressing and that sort of stuff in the Premier League, which makes it more exciting. But I just think I didn't watch that match, the derby you refer to, but I've watched enough La Liga this season to see that the gap, which I think had already opened up in the last few seasons between those two leagues, has just gotten bigger, in my opinion.
Yeah, and the gap between La Liga and Major League Soccer is immense. Kartik, I don't know.
It's not even worth discussing.
Well, right? I'll mention it just because I don't watch a lot of Major League Soccer games. This past week, I did watch more than I usually do. I watched the DC United Columbus game, which was a kickball game. It was a scrappy game. It was exciting from the point of view of it going down to penalty kicks and just, you know, was it going to be DC going through or was it going to be Columbus going through? So that excitement level was good. The actual football itself was pretty poor. And then I watched NYCFC against Atlanta United. Again, another important match in Major League Soccer. But still to this day, since day one, I've hated that pitch. But it's to me, it's not even a game of soccer. It's a completely different type of game. Both teams play differently on a pitch that's that small at Yankee Stadium. There's no width. So it is very much just, you mean, it's a completely different game. It's kind of like playing 5v5 on a 5v5 pitch versus playing a full-size football. And then also, too, you almost need to have, I don't know, seven aside on the Yankees pitch to make it more watchable. Because when you have 11 players from both sides, 22 players crammed into the small pitch, to me, it's almost unwatchable. And again, it's a great win for Atlanta United in that first leg, and it's a must. You know, it's an important match. But for me, as a viewer tuning in, I'm like completely turned off by this. And maybe there were some better games in Major League Soccer in the playoffs, MLS Cup playoffs, than the other matches. I didn't see them, but for me, it wasn't a good look.
Not really. It was really disappointing, and it was really disappointing coming after the last few seasons of the MLS Cup playoffs, where, you know, we've criticized MLS during the course of the season, Chris, on this show, and then we get to the playoffs, and particularly this first weekend and the midweek playing games in the first weekend and say, oh my gosh, the players have raised their level because there's something on the line. And the weather is a little cooler and crisper. There's better movement, better passing. I didn't see it. And I watched, I probably watched more Major League Soccer this week than any other league because, again, election got in the way and MLS, the timings of the games were more convenient for me. I'm very disappointed by what I've seen in the playoffs. I think the Salt Lake Kansas City game was a little better than the others. That first leg of that two leg tie, but Portland Seattle was exciting, but a little bit underwhelming in terms of the quality of football. Given it's those two teams, and Portland looks very different under Gio Savarese, a coach I know pretty well, than they did under Caleb Porter. Just the way they play, so they're less entertaining from my standpoint. And then that Columbus DC match, I have to say, was a horrible disappointment for me. I mean, I just thought that was going to be some really good football between two teams playing very well coming into the playoffs and two sides that are peaking at the right time. And on a high between the Rooney Acosta high of DC United and the new stadium and Columbus keeping the team in Columbus. But what we saw, Chris, was a situation where a one-off, like any one-off cup match, where there isn't a replay and you can play for penalties. This happens in international competitions, international tournaments. I just thought that there was a lot of sloppiness, a lot of tactical chicanery, if you want to call it that. So I wasn't impressed with MLS this weekend. I'm hoping the coming weekend is better. I assume it will be because it's second legs and it's do or die for all eight sides involved. And the fact that in that Atlanta-New York City FC tie that Atlanta has the lead means that New York City FC has to go away from home and go after it. And then I think it's the same thing even in the other ties in terms of just them being tightly edged and the team that's on the, away from home not being able to sit in bunker, with the possible exception, obviously, of Columbus, who did not give away a goal to Red Bull.
Yeah, and we saw earlier this season, too, it was a really good game between NYCFC and Atlanta United in Atlanta. So hopefully the second leg will live up to that. Now, Kartik, of course, we've got the Champions League. We had the Champions League this week. Turner Sports returning to the coverage of the league, as well as, of course, Univision. And for me, in 2.5 months of Turner producing the Champions League, they've been able to improve their coverage to a point that it's better than anything that Fox has done over the last 6 years when they had the rights. It's not perfect. There were a couple of fumbles and a couple of other mistakes, but it's massively improved. And at the end of the day, it's watchable. The actual pre-game coverage, post-game coverage, halftime is very short. But it's watchable, which is a lot more I can say that I can say about Fox's coverage. Having said that, Kartik, let me just chime in with one more thing. If there was ever a golden opportunity to go ahead and do a post-match interview with a manager after a game, it was on Wednesday with Jose Mourinho, and they didn't do it. They did the regular thing, but just too much talk, and they went to, at the end, I don't know if you saw it, they played Golf Clash in the studio and to promote their upcoming golf thing they've got coming up on Bleacher Report Live. But to me, it's valuable time to play the damn post-match interview with Jose. So I had to go ahead and tweet it out last night for everyone that missed it. I said, okay, here it is. For those of you who watched TNT and didn't see the interview, the post-match, and it was pretty good, here it is. Kartik, go ahead with what you want to say. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I think in terms of pregame show, now I'll concede Wednesday my phone was ringing off the hook, angry Democrats in Florida complimenting me on my critiques of the party and the party's failures again in this election. So I didn't see the pregame show. I didn't see much of the action until later in the afternoon. I did see Manchester United's two goals, which for our former co-host of this show, Nipun Chopra, Marouane Fellaini, he is the greatest of all time. Just point that out for Nipun, since he's so anti-Fellaini. I thought on Tuesday, and it was a great diversion for me because I was getting election coverage and updating my running commentary on the election on my website, political website, during the day. It was such a great diversion at noon. And I have to tell you, yes, they don't do the pregame. And I know this is a bugaboo of yours. They don't do the pregame stand-ups with the coaches or with the players. They don't show the bus pulling in like Fox used to do, which I thought was a lot of filler for Fox to work around not actually analyzing the matches and you know, using their pregame shows to promote Major League Soccer and U.S. Soccer. I actually thought Tuesday, the analysis and the buildup for Tuesday's matches was pretty good in that pregame show. And I would agree. I mean, it might seem like a hyperbolic statement, what you said a few minutes ago and what I'm going to repeat here, but I think it's better than anything Fox produced in 8 years of covering the Champions League in terms of just focusing on the Champions League itself. I know a lot of people.
You could tell on the Tuesday one that they did their homework. So I think they had a segment on Kubayi, the Napoli defender, and so Tim Howard has some good points about defenders in Serie A and how it's different there. Mo was much improved. I think Carlos Bocanegra was better. I think everyone was better. They came in with some good analysis, and I thought, okay, this is good. This is good stuff. This is the type of coverage that we would expect to see on NBC SN. It was that good. And I thought also the tactical board with Stuart Holden and Steve Nash, kind of a halftime and pregame and postgame, kind of analyzing that in terms of positions, that was good.
But why did it take 4 weeks to get that? I mean, that was really good. Yeah. I agree. Why did it take 4 weeks for that?
Yeah, well, you'll have to ask Turner next time you interview them. I think you're probably going to interview them in a couple of weeks, but that'll be a good question for them to say, hey, why so late on this one?
Let me point out one thing real quickly. So I got a lot of criticism because in reaction to this pregame show, even though every other tweet I think I had on Tuesday was political, was election related, the one tweet I had soccer related was, hey, look, Turner's ahead of Fox now, and Fox used the pregame show for propaganda purposes. I had a lot of blowback on that. Now, let me just point out once again, my critique is that they used Champions League, where most of the viewers who were tuning were interested in Champions League. Yes, you can say they're Americans and they're soccer fans, but they were interested in Champions League and European football. They used that pregame show to try and force feed Major League Soccer and the U.S. men's national team or any U.S. men's national team related storyline down the throats of European football fans. Now, I can see why they did it, given that that property to them in their mind is more valuable, and they're into kind of nationalism and Americanizing everything. But I think for the actual consumer of the Champions League, of European football, they're much happier with Turner's approach, even if they don't necessarily love the voices involved, that they're not being told this guy's going to move from this Major League Soccer team to that Major League Soccer team. So that's what I meant by it. It wasn't a statement about production or a statement about Americanism. It was a statement about just that very tenor of Fox.
Yeah, and it wasn't just U.S. men's national team or Major League Soccer, Kartik. It was USSF. It was USSF basically. I mean, Grant Wall being fed stories and regurgitating them on Fox's news and pushing a narrative. And that's what the issue. I mean, we've talked about this for the past 12 months. That's what the issue was. Which Turner Sports, I mean, it's all focused on the analysis, especially the pregame. So that's what it should be. The other thing about Fox is that one of the reasons they did it was was also because of the viewing audience. They knew that there were a lot more people tuning in to watch. Champions League, whichever, on a Tuesday or Wednesday, than there would be for a Major League Soccer game on a Sunday. So it's a bigger audience. More people are watching it. Which is exactly the way that they used it to get their, get their information out there, basically propaganda. What I would say though, Kartik, was that with the pregame, I have no problems with not showing pregame interviews with managers or players, just because it's very, very rare that they say anything interesting. Sometimes maybe Klopp or maybe Mourinho, so far as like a late tactical change or Pogba not playing. That could have be worthy of an actual kind of showing that interview pregame. But for the most part, Tuesday and Wednesday, I thought the pregame was good, and I really enjoyed it, and I think they've come a long way. The other thing about Tuesdays too, that post-match, they're doing a much better job of providing the highlights of the different games and the main talking points. So both Tuesday and Wednesday, I walked away thinking, okay, I knew exactly what happened today. The flow was much better. I walked away thinking, okay, I've got a full Champions League day with all the highlights and goals and storylines. I know exactly what happened and walk away happy. But so overall, really, really good. Actually, Kate Abdo too, Kartik, I'm not sure if you noticed this, is getting better Tuesday, definitely. Wednesday. She was asking tougher questions, and which caught some of the analysts back by surprise. And I think Tim Howard once or twice wasn't able to answer the question, and Kate Abdo came back again and asked the question again. So I thought that was good. She was punchier. The analysts in return weren't as good, but hopefully that'll just take a little bit of time to get adjusted to that.
Another question for Turner when I interview them in a few weeks. It makes all the difference to have Tim Howard both days of a match day. And what are they going to do about next season? They have this package for 3 years at a minimum. We'll talk about Super League and all that later in the show. But what are they going to have to do to get him every day while he's still an active player? Because I think there is an even when they were clunky the first few weeks, Chris, there was a definite difference when he was in that studio and when he wasn't. A definite upgrade with him. And obviously he's a veteran, not only a veteran player and a great player, but I think those reps he did with NBC while an active Premier League player, calling matches with Arlo White and Steve Bower from the gantry in England, really has helped him transition into this role, but not the days they don't have him have been the worst days that they've had on record in their coverage.
Yeah, it might be chemistry. I'm still not sold on his tactical analysis. He does offer some good points at times from a personal point of view in terms of, you mean, the experience he's had in certain instances. But chemistry-wise, it's good because chemistry-wise, they're more relaxed on the set. They're having fun. They're a little bit of banter back and forth. And they seem more confident. And both Tuesday and Wednesday showed that. Even Wednesday with the golf clash thing, which was really pretty stupid, it was still fun and watchable. Although I was still saying to myself, where are the post-match interviews with the managers? Because even Stu Holden, after the Juventus-Man United game, he said on air, he says, what do you think Allegri is saying to his team after this breakdown? And I said to myself, yeah, what is he saying? Let's see the post-match interview with Allegri to see if he said anything about that. I mean, did he explain what happened? I mean, was it a masterclass for Man United, or was it just, I mean, pure luck? Whatever it is, it's something that Stu's asking, he's thinking about, and we are as the viewers too. So definitely a missed opportunity, but overall much, much improved. And actually, we have some feedback from one of the listeners. Let me pull it up right here. And that is from John Clee Charlton. And he says, the BR TNT pregame show is much better. I really think they are listening to the pod and our opinions of the coverage. Excellent work, guys. Thank you for a great pod, as always. And that's for sure. I mean, we know from the interview we did in the last episode, they are listening. And it's not just to you and me, Kartik. It's to the soccer fans, the hardcore soccer fans. And they've definitely, this week, you can tell, made a huge push to really kind of focus on more of the English language speaking fans and having, you mean, Univision do the Inter-Barcelona game. And really focusing on trying to really kind of, I think, probably trying to grab that NBC SN audience and ride those coattails and trying to bring in some new viewers that way. It's working. I really think it's a big turnaround from what they were just like, what, a month ago.
Yeah, and I think the other thing we're finding is that there are times now that they're showing different games than Univision. So they have made the commitment not only to the type of coverage that would appeal to NBC viewers, but also the teams. You're seeing English teams, basically. And Univision is committed to showing Spanish teams and PSV because of the Mexican influence.
Exactly, yeah. And I'm not sure if that is orchestrated. I mean, that could be something where they have a phone call with Univision and say, hey, right, we're taking this one, you take this one. I don't think so. I think it's more in terms of them saying, okay, hey, the Spanish language audience, they're going to gravitate towards Univision, so why try to beat them at their own game? Let's focus on the English language speaking audience and then hope that we can pull some people in additional on our side too. So I think it's working. We'll have to wait and see on the TV ratings numbers to see if it's working that way. But in the column, actually, at worldsoccertalk.com, we posted last week, numbers are up. Numbers are – the pregame coverage is up. I don't have the percentages in front of me, but up big time compared to Fox. And the viewership on the UEFA Champions League games on TNT are higher than Fox for the group stage. So it's working. One more game, Kartik, I want to point out, and that was on Friday I watched Galatasaray against Fenerbahce from the Turkish Super League. It was actually a good game. It was a really entertaining game, ended up 2-2. Two things to point out from this one is at the end of the game, it was crazy, absolutely crazy. The referee blew the whistle, and all of a sudden there's, you mean, a pitch invasion, but not by the fans, it's by the actual coaching staff, the substitutes, the players. And they were like chasing each other around the pitch. They had the police came out with riot gear. They were fighting. It was wild. I still don't know exactly what happened, but it was entertaining to say the least. The game was good too. The other thing was Andreas Cordero and George Metellus on the commentary. And while the commentary, they're good, they don't just have the same type of passion that we had when we had Cordero and Matteo Bonetti. That partnership was really good as far as kind of Cordero being the straight guy and Bonetti being kind of more the, I mean, the wild and passionate and kind of the crazy, I mean, just really passionate as a co-commentator. And George and Cordero are very kind of straight in terms of the way that they perform, the way that they commentate. So it was kind of, it was missing the passion of a big, big game like this one. But a good game to watch regardless.
Yeah, and I'm always, when anytime I see Galatasaray or Fenerbahce or Beşiktaş play, I notice the passion from the fans,
yeah.
Chris, and I also notice that there are a bunch of players that names we recognize, thinking, oh, that's where they are now.
Yeah, it was funny at that game. It was almost like a Premier League, I don't know, like a kind of a, what do you call it, like a high school reunion. It was like a Premier League reunion.
Yeah.
Going down the list of players, I'm like, oh my gosh, he's still playing? And you know, names we know, I mean, from the past like decade, playing in Fenerbahce.
Yeah, and it's the same thing for the other leagues too. It's a La Liga reunion. It's
right.
A Bundesliga reunion,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's like the whole, every player's name in that derby you recognize.
Oh yeah, definitely. So they're good players, a little bit older, and it's entertaining, and the fans are crazy, so that's always a good watch. All right, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
Yeah, this is an exciting new documentary Netflix will be releasing next month called "In Sunderland Till I Die," which charts the fall of the team from the Premier League to League One, as well as the plight of former chairman Ellis Short, the American, who lost $250 million on the team. While the documentary isn't out yet, it's listed on Netflix, so you can add it to my list, and you'll see it appear when it's released. Real quickly on this, Chris, when I was in London a few months ago, there was a lot of talk about how interesting people around the game thought this documentary would be compared to Manchester City, which had just been released at that point, the Amazon documentary, and then the Netflix Juventus documentary, whose second season had just been released at that point. Because the thinking was that following a successful club that wins trophies, while you get a sense of like Allegri's coaching methods and Guardiola's coaching methods and the brilliance of Sterling and the brilliance of Buffon and whoever else, it is more interesting to follow a club that is in a bit of a crisis and to get a peek behind the veil as to what happens there. So there's a lot of excitement about this documentary, and I have to go on record, Chris, and saying my favorite football documentary, the one documentary I make sure I watch every 3 or 4 months as someone who works in this sport, is the QPR 4-year plan documentary, because it's the same sort of thing. This might even be better, because I think we're going to get a deeper dive, a longer look at Sunderland in this documentary. So I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, so it's called Sunderland Till I Die. I think it'll be interesting to see if they have any cameras on the inside. So from the outside, the person that's producing the film or directing the film is a Sunderland supporter. So I can definitely picture a lot of interviews with some diehard Sunderland fans that have supported the club through generations, talking about the demise of the club. But whether or not we'll see some footage inside the club, that'll be interesting to see, just to kind of get a better understanding of how this great club, I mean, it's still a great club, has fallen down to League One, which is definitely a shame. Now, in terms of El Clasico, so October 28th was the El Clasico between Barcelona and Real Madrid. It averaged more than 500,000 viewers in the United States on beIN Sports and beIN Sports en Español. Despite El Clasico not featuring Messi and Ronaldo playing in the game for the first time in almost a decade, the match at the Nou Camp averaged 363,000 viewers on beIN Sports en Español, as well as 181,000 viewers on the English language TV channel, for a combined average of 544,000 viewers, which is 35% down from the same time last year. And depending on which way you look at this, Kartik, it's either positive news or negative news. I mean, the negative news is this is not good for La Liga. This is not good for beIN Sports. It really, to me, the main issue is distribution, not being on DirecTV, not being on DirecTV Now, not being on Comcast. The positive news, if you can take any positive news from this, is that the number is actually probably a little bit better than what we anticipated. And especially with no Messi and no Ronaldo going on to Serie A, Messi beIN injured, maybe it's not so bad. But at the end of the day, it's still, for the biggest game, biggest club game of the year, it's the dominant game. This 544,000 viewers is not good enough, and if I'm La Liga, I'm upset.
Yep, I am too. I think it's a situation, Chris, where they got to solve this before next season. It's November now. I guess they're stuck. They have another year after that on their contract with beIN Sport, but they got to find a way to either increase distribution or have beIN Sport sub-license the bigger matches, which BN is not going to do willingly or very willingly, because I think the issue is they'll never get back on cable systems if they're not showing El Clasico. So it's a bad situation for La Liga in this country. And
it's a lose lose because even with BN Sports, I mean, if BN Sports, like you said, that gives away some of the leverage that they have in terms of being the exclusive provider to La Liga. They're paying $120 million a year for the rights to La Liga to show it exclusively. But the reality is this, I mean, at the end of the 2019-2020 season is going to be La Liga's last season on beIN Sports. And the likelihood of La Liga renewing with beIN Sports is practically zero. So at the summer of 2020, either beIN Sports goes out of business in the United States or decides to downgrade and start just showing some other leagues and just try to have massive layoffs and just get by, La Liga is going to move on. La Liga is going to go to a much bigger channel with much bigger distribution. And you look at Bundesliga. The Bundesliga has much greater distribution than La Liga does. And La Liga is a much better league than the Bundesliga. And we've seen that from the TV ratings, even though that Bundesliga's on Fox on some big channels, and La Liga's on beIN Sports, which now is in approximately about 10 million homes, so pretty small, is that La Liga's getting bigger TV ratings than the Bundesliga is on Fox. So it's a lose-lose situation for both La Liga and beIN Sports, and I don't see them. I mean, hopefully they do sublicense the games, but it's going to just increase the. I mean, if I'm Dish Network, or I'm DirecTV, and I'm thinking about, or maybe it's another network, maybe it's another big, huge TV provider, I'm going to question whether or not it's worth actually continuing having beIN Sports if they're going to lose La Liga in the summer of 2020 anyway. Like, why should we have them on the channel if there's, once La Liga goes, what is the left other than Liga and the Turkish Super League? All right, Kartik, so speaking of that, which kind of evolves into a couple of news topics that do relate to that, to beIN Sports and the situation and the whole world of European soccer, which got turned upside down just after last week's podcast. I'll let you clue the viewers and listeners into the next news item.
Yeah, so last week we talked about how FIFA said La Liga would be unable to feature the Girona-Barcelona match in Miami because of a FIFA statute. However, La Liga has responded, and they responded soon after we were off the air, stating that, quote, there is no jurisdiction for FIFA to approve or block the game. As a matter of fact, FIFA's own rules and regulations for international matches clearly state the approval process for all international games and concludes that FIFA only needs to be informed after the local federations, in this case, the Spanish Federation and the U.S. Federation, and regional confederations, in this case, UEFA and CONCACAF, have been approved. Now, that is true. However, I think that this is a gray area because that statute applies to international matches between national teams. Or at least was written with the thought of international matches between national teams and friendly matches, right? Non-competitive matches. This is a competitive match, first off, not a friendly, in a domestic club football league. So I think you can interpret it with that statute, and no doubt La Liga's attorneys have done that and done that well. But I'm saying my understanding is the statute as written by FIFA was written with something completely else in mind. This is an unprecedented event, an unprecedented challenge. Mm-hmm. So let's see how legally it shakes out.
And even if what La Liga is saying is correct, I mean, if that, say, did pass the test, for example, and that FIFA has no say over whether or not they need to approve this, it's easier said than done, because they're also saying that USSF and CONCACAF have to approve it, which, you know, Kartik, that they're not going to approve that. I mean, that opens up everything in terms of if they approve that, then all of a sudden you get other leagues coming into the United States, and that undermines Major League Soccer in their viewpoints. So it's going to be a legal mess, I think, Kartik. I think we're going to go to the courts on this one. And with the game being on January 26, there may not be time to actually get it approved in time, but we'll have to wait and see. So speaking of the world being turned upside down with a lot of changes, late last week, Kartik, the revelations came out from Der Spiegel from and Football Leaks, the site that has been leaking documents. Really, I mean, the main thing is the European Super League revelations that there's a binding agreement that 11 clubs have signed, or actually have agreed to, and they're about to sign in November 2018, as well as five guest clubs that would be added. And this would go ahead and replace the UEFA Champions League in 2021. It would also mean that the clubs involved would leave their respective domestic leagues. And so you have the likes of Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Manchester City, Manchester United, Liverpool, etc. Leaving the Premier League and Bundesliga and La Liga and leaving the UEFA Champions League and playing this European Super League. And there was also some revelations about some of the abuse of the financial fair play system in this. My thoughts, Kartik, on this one, I want to get your thoughts too, is I do not like it. I do not like it because it's all focused on the money. It's all focused on trying to take the money out of the pockets of UEFA and put them into the pockets of these, really, these 11 top super clubs in Europe in a system with no promotion, no relegation. And this is completely a move, really, to become the NFL. It's to become, which is what I hate the most about the NFL, is that it's a closed system. It's a very predictable, boring, it's a league that's made for television, really, at the end of the day.
Right.
And everything that's wrong with the NFL is the same thing that's wrong with this European Super League idea. I just hate it. I hope it does not happen.
You can't assume that every closed league looks exactly the same. I mean, I would argue that Major League Baseball is more open than the NFL is, for instance. It's not an open league, don't get me wrong, but that there's more openness in the way teams can market themselves, player contracts, that sort of thing. This European Super League concept, I have to say, it's something I'm very much against. Have the same ideological arguments that everyone else is making. I don't necessarily have to rehash them. I think most of the listeners agree with me. The one positive I can see in it, Chris, and this sounds horrible, is that maybe with these elite clubs leaving domestic leagues, breaking off, creating their own closed league, their own closed structure, we don't have to worry about them anymore, and we will have good, competitive football, open football, in the top domestic leagues in Europe. That's my one hope. If this were actually to come to fruition, I could say, you know what? I don't even have to watch Bayern Munich ever again in my life. I don't have to watch Real Madrid ever again in my life. I can watch Eibar. I can watch Deportivo Alaves. I can watch Sunderland. I can watch Wolves. I can watch Freiburg and Darmstadt and see competitive football.
Yeah.
So, you know, be careful what you wish for if you're the big clubs, because I think there's a certain attraction of domestic competitive club football to the majority of people who enjoy the ethos of this sport. Now, maybe front runners, maybe people who are just general sports fans around the globe are going to gravitate to the Super League, the consumers in Asia, the consumers, the football consumers here in the United States. But I think the domestic audiences in these European countries are probably going to fall back in love with their domestic leagues if this happens.
Yeah, there would be two different leagues, Kartik. In my estimation, there would be a TV league, which would be the European Super League, and then there would be a league that the fans would go to. The fans would really gravitate to and have a great community aspect of it, and maybe bring back some of the, I mean, the better days of football from the past, where it did seem to be a closer connection between the fans and the players and the actual fans and the clubs. But to me, this whole thing, I mean, from a TV perspective, Kartik, this is one thing I went ahead and did. So I think 3 or 4 days ago, I posted on Twitter, posted a poll and said, okay, you mean whether you're for or against the European Super League idea, would you watch it? Would you watch it, or no, wouldn't watch it? And it was 50-50. It was 50% that said, yes, I would watch it. Regrettably, sometimes some of the people said, like, yeah, it's just I don't agree with it, but I would watch it. And then 50% said, no, I'm definitely not going to watch it. So that, and that's not scientific by any means, but it gives you an idea of, like, even though there's going to be a lot of people against it, people will watch it because it is the big clubs. And that's the thing too. These big clubs have huge fan bases. If you're a fan of Manchester United, well, you're a fan of Manchester City. Would you stop watching Manchester City play your club that you've supported since the 1980s? Would you stop watching them if they played in this league?
That's a great question. Maybe I would. I mean, I probably not. But I will say right now, and our fan base is a little different than that of these other big European clubs. Our supporters base at Manchester City, because of where we've come from and because kind of the ethos of the club prior to Sheikh Mansour's takeover, has never been enthralled with European football the way that United's fan base is, or Chelsea's fan base is, the London clubs in particular, and obviously the big clubs on the continent. So I think it's riskier for City. Now, City to be in the money league and in the category they want to be in as essentially a billboard for Abu Dhabi would have to be part of the Super League. But I think City's fan base itself might be much more divided on this than United's or Chelsea's or Bayern's or Madrid's. I think Bayern itself is probably pushing it because as a club, they're being – They feel like they're being brought back down to the mean in the Bundesliga because the Bundesliga has very strict, structured, and to me, ideal rules about ownership. But that also means that you can't go and solicit the kind of investment that Manchester City, PSG, Chelsea, and any number of clubs in Spain, even Valencia, have gotten if you're Bayern. You know, you're stuck where you are. But would I watch it? That's a very good question, Chris. I mean, I guess I would take my cue from other City fans. I think there are a lot of City fans who they're pleased to see Manchester City's name in these leagues alongside Bayern, Real Madrid, Barcelona, because that means in some ways our club has made it. But the flip side of it is we've never been enamored with European football. It's not what we grew up on. It's not the ethos of the club. It was cool the first couple of years to have Juventus and Real Madrid and Bayern come into the Etihad. But now it's like, we'd rather win domestic trophies. We'd rather, you know, focus on English football. So that's a very good question. Now, as far as fans of other big clubs, Chris, I guess they'll split. And they'll split from their domestic leagues and watch this. But will non-fans of those clubs watch it? I don't know. Or will fans of other clubs pick a big club to support, like they pick an NFL team? I don't think so.
Yeah, I think they will. I'm against it, but from a TV perspective, I can see. Okay, so the Champions League rights are up about 2021. The Premier League TV deal is up about 2022. So the timing of it could actually happen where, you mean, once the new TV deal for the Champions League is negotiated, and it's running from 2022 onwards, probably to 2025. At that time, it's a good time, not a good time, but it's a good opportunity for the TV people and the leagues to actually do some deals where there is a European Super League that starts around about that time, which would diminish the Premier League TV revenue and the UEFA Champions League revenue. And I could see, Kartik, I could see Fox coming in and saying, hey, we want to get behind this. We want to have the rights to the European Super League. This leads in perfectly to the World Cup in 2026. We want to build up their audience. Yes, we've lost the Champions League. We've lost the Premier League. But we're back. We want to make a huge commitment. And we want to bring these viewers in, get them hooked on the best soccer from around the world, around Europe, and have them, basically draw all this new audience in so that by the time of 2026 World Cup, they are going crazy and ratings are through the roof. I can see that happening. Now, from a TV viewing perspective, I think the first season would be interesting. There'd be some competitive matches. But after that, with no relegation, yes, you have a title winner. I think there is going to be like a group stage idea, and then there's like a knockout stage idea. Probably by the second season, we start to see, okay, well, this looks kind of a little bit predictable. By the third season, forget about it. It's going to be just, okay, it's the same teams pretty much winning it now. Real Madrid wins it again for the third time in a row type of thing. So from a TV perspective, it would decline. Having the guest clubs in freshens it up a little bit. But this guarantees for those 11 clubs 20 years of a NFL system where they're not going to get relegated. Those 11 teams are guaranteed for 20 years to be in this league. They're thinking long term. From a TV perspective, I can see this working. Regrettably, I can see this working, and I can see people like Fox, and I can see other broadcasters around the world saying, "Hey, we're going to get in on this," because the fan bases for Real Madrid, Barcelona, Man United alone, just those three clubs, there's enough viewers there that that they can sell advertising on, and sponsorships and all sorts of things. And And Kartik, we have to remember that the whole thing that's driving this whole idea of a European Super League concept in the first place is the NFL. And that is the NFL owner, Stephen Ross, who is a billionaire, who owns Relevant Sports. And it's Charlie Stolitano, one of the Relevant Sports employees that's been driving this, has been having the secret meetings in London with the big clubs to try to make this a reality. So at the end of the day, this is the NFL or an NFL owner trying to change soccer, trying to change soccer as we know it and make it into more of an American sports idea. This is the whole concept and the whole success of the NFL. It's been a closed system. There's been a global league that's growing in popularity. That, I'm sure, Stephen Ross, the owner of the Miami Dolphins, looks at this and goes, okay, well, why can't soccer be like the NFL? Why can't we have a closed system? Why can't we have millions of fans from around the world and then millions of dollars of a global TV audience? You mean all these different broadcasters paying top dollar to watch this European Super League? And I don't know, it looks like it's going to happen. And it's all driven really by the NFL philosophy.
And we know for the longest time, those clubs have not necessarily been committed to growing their league. I mean, I think that this is something we see all over Europe. I mean, our friend and colleague, you know, the esteemed Derek Gray, has talked extensively in the past about Scottish football and how the big clubs there, particularly Celtic, have not necessarily looked out for the best interests of Scottish football in general. And I think that's the case with so many of these clubs. In the Premier League, there seemed to be a certain strength in numbers in terms of big clubs, and in some other leagues that are lower profile leagues, there might be some strength in parity. But in Germany, Spain, and Italy in particular, and France now, sorry, there is a tendency to want to break away if you're PSG, if you're Bayern, and Bayern has the structural limitations because of Germany that we've talked about in terms of how much revenue they can bring in. So they're in the most needy shape of all these big clubs in terms of needing that NFL-styled closed league TV money that they can bank on for 10 or 20 years. Yeah, and I don't know, Chris. The more you talk about it this morning, it's alarming to me because, you know, I thought that the fan reaction, the subsequent outcry when the football leaks first came, and Der Spiegel and The Guardian published some of this stuff, would be an effective pushback. Now, as time has gone on, I've been distracted by the election, as we said, but I've kept my finger on the pulse, and it's swinging back the other way. People saying, you know, this is going to happen. This was always going to happen. Mm-hmm. We thought it might happen 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And listening to you this morning, I think maybe it's an inevitability, as distasteful as it is for us that fell in love with football because of the community aspect of it and the real ethos and culture around the sport. Maybe this is just the new reality we're going to have to adjust to, however unpleasant it is.
Yeah, and this is, even though it's a European Super League, in reality, it's a global league. And it's the same thing for the NFL. The NFL is an American league, but in reality, it's a global league. They're banking on people from, you know, South America, from Africa, from Asia, tuning in just because of Neymar, tuning in to watch PSG, tuning in to watch Aguero or Gabriel Jesus.
And like the NFL, taking now 4 games a season to London, which is a ridiculous amount, honestly.
Which I can see that. I can see that too.
They will take these games to China. They will take these games to North America.
Right, to New York, for sure. Yeah. And the way things are heading, I see it happening. And it could actually happen, Kartik, as early, possibly an agreement as early as next week. SoccerX is going to be in Miami. You're going to have all of the leaders of the different leagues and the different clubs in Miami all together. Okay. So that could happen there.
You and I are both registered to attend SoccerX. Obviously, next week at this time, we'll both be at the conference. I am blown away by the attendees list. There's been some talk in the industry that SoccerX as a forum, as a venue, isn't as prominent as it was a decade ago, particularly like 7 to 8 years ago. But judging by the attendees list, everybody's coming. And I would not bet against some sort of preliminary agreement being hashed out, whether we learn about it next week or we learn about it well into the future at this conference. So we'll be on the ground there, both Chris and I, and we'll bring you all up to date on the developments one way or another.
Yep. And let's talk about FFP just for a minute. I know sometimes the financial fair play system can be a little bit boring, but we do have a question from one of our listeners, actually some comments. This is John Average Geek. He says, the more I learn about FFP, the more I believe it's not about balance. It's about protecting and maintaining the power of a few. PSG and Manchester City challenged that system. Real reform would put regulations on the transfer market. Any thoughts about that, Kartik? Also, being a Manchester City fan and all the revelations about City really kind of working behind the scenes with UEFA to get around this whole FFP, kind of ban and just paying a penalty, kind of a slap on the wrist.
FFP to me has always been a sham. It's been this thing that would lock in the hegemony of the Bayerns, of the Manchester Uniteds, the Juventuses, the Real Madrids. On the Manchester City revelations, look, the Etihad thing, even as a Manchester City supporter, I have been screaming about for a year because I also follow the airline industry, as you know, Chris, yep. And know the kind of financial shape Etihad is in. I have tweeted, you can go back and I know my timeline is filled with lots of assorted tweets on various subjects, but if you really scoured my timeline, you'd notice four or five times in the last 12 months I've talked about why isn't UEFA and the American soccer press looking into this more closely because of the Etihad sponsorship with Major League Soccer, which came presumably through City Football Group and their investment in New York City FC. And cricket, no one has reacted to anything I've said about it. And now that Football Leaks has revealed essentially the Etihad sponsorship, because Etihad themselves do not have the resources to pay for this. Just as a point of background, they've had to cut routes, they've had to sell airplanes, and they have also had to divest from several other outside entities that they had they'd invested 20 or 30%, bought 20 or 30% of the stock in those companies. So they're in bad shape. It looks like that the Etihad sponsorship was actually paid for once those shortfalls began to occur with Etihad's revenue by Manchester City itself, just to kind of mask the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But I just think FFP in general has been a sham. It has been a deterrent to try and prevent clubs from emerging and challenging the top rung of European football. So the clubs that have actually been punished by FFP in England, at least, have been QPR and Leicester. Mm-hmm. Now, Leicester was able to still, kind of maybe violate FFP rules. I know there are people who still they poo-poo Leicester's accomplishment and say, oh, well, they were violating the rules. Well, there was no way for them in their state to win a Premier League title, to compete with Chelsea and Manchester City and Manchester United and Arsenal without, flaunting the rules a little bit. Because this system was designed to lock in a hegemony of top clubs. Just like, so now if the system is not working to lock in that hegemony, those clubs will just leave and create their own Super League. I guess that's the lesson of all of this. So they're gonna take their toys and go play somewhere else if FFP proves to be toothless, which it has. Look, I think the bottom line on all of this, Chris, for our listeners, is the power and petulance of the big football clubs in Europe. That's the takeaway from all of it.
And it's gotten out of hand. And
yes,
it's going to get even more out of hand. So just one more thing about this, though, Kartik, is that La Liga president Javier Tebas came out this week to criticize UEFA for the way they've bent the rules to allow PSG and Man City to continue participating in the Champions League despite breaking financial fair play rules. By doing so, Tebas has caused a further wedge in La Liga's relationship with beIN Sports, since beIN is owned by the same institution that owns PSG. He was asked about the potential of upsetting beIN Sports and driving a wedge or a rift between beIN Sports and PSG, and with all the criticism of UEFA and PSG breaking the rules. Tebas responded in the New York Times. He said, if beIN Sports are not willing to buy La Liga rights, then we'll go someplace else to sell them. Which, again, we know that that's going to happen anyway, but he's kind of just saying that, this PSG thing, he's criticizing PSG, which at the same time, when he's criticizing PSG, he's criticizing beIN Sports because they're owned by the same institution.
Right.
Right, Kartik, let's move on, and we've got just one more news item, just a big game this weekend that's going to be on US TV.
Yeah, so it's the Copa Libertadores final, which I think everybody is excited about because it's Boca River. it's going to be quite a spectacle. It'll be on Fox Deportes and Fanatis, which has been a great source for South American soccer in general.
Yeah, so that's Saturday, November 10th. The kickoff is 3 p.m. on Fanatis, which is a free trial, and Fox Deportes on television, which you can also get through Fubo. And that's the first leg. The second leg is going to be on November 24th. The Saturday's game is at La Bombonera, Boca, playing at home. And then the second game at Estadio Monumental. And that should be a fantastic game too. Moving on to TV ratings, we will have the full list at worldsoccertalk.com. Just a few to throw out there. Arsenal against Liverpool on Saturday on NBC. 874,000 viewers on the English language side. We don't have the Spanish language side yet, so maybe that went over a million. We'll have to wait and see. From the Major League Soccer playoff games, MLS Cup playoff games, Columbus against New York Red Bulls on ESPN, 257,000 viewers. Then we had Portland-Seattle on Sunday on ESPN, 323,000 viewers. Again, Kartik, ESPN does well with Major League Soccer. And then FS1 had, what did they have? They had the Real Salt Lake against Sporting KC game on Sunday on FS1 that had 145,000 viewers. But they did have the NYCFC Atlanta game on Sunday on FS1 and that did 225. So better there. But overall for October, it was a tough month for Major League Soccer. Out of the top 25 most watched soccer games in October, only one Major League Soccer game registered in that top 25, and that was at number 24, and that was a game that was televised on Univision, not ESPN nor FS1. Moving on to listener mailbag, we have Mitch Carr. He says, I'm a new listener as of August. I love the podcast. My personal thoughts on BR Live and especially their halftime is that they're just trying to cram too much in. They'd benefit greatly from simplifying things. They might as well not run highlights. Yeah, and it's still Kartik. I haven't done a timer yet, but those halftime shows are so short. They seem so much shorter than Fox's. It's just commercial, commercial, commercial. Come back for like maybe 30 seconds, then go back to commercials. It's really jam-packed. And I agree with Mitch. It is sometimes too much to cram in. NPOB Sports on Twitter says, listening now on the 44-minute mark on last week's podcast, the BR guy was a bore and added nothing of interest for anyone listening to become interested in watching. MLS viewing facts, thank you. La Liga fighting this Miami game is short-sighted. FIFA to block this game, sure. Then enforce promotion relegation. Julian Palmer says, the interest on Neymar's tattoos. LA is where it's at. He was indeed terrible. It won't be long and not soon enough until UEFA Champions League rights go to someone else. Ben says, it's the Instagram influencer angle they're going for. The true football nuts aren't interested in that. And then last but not least, Tim Keane says, I just saw Neil Ashton's segment on NBC about the Super League. By the way, I always find this segment very interesting and I find his opinions very informative. He mentioned nowhere in all of the discussions have the fans been thought about. Full disclosure, I'm a Watford fan, and I think that if I had to make a choice between watching Watford in the Premier League without the Super Clubs and the Super League, no contest. Vicarage Road every time. I think we enjoy many Champions League games because they do create some great matchups after the group stage, but that's because we don't see them on a regular basis. And that's a perfect... Perfect answer to that, Kartik. I completely agree 100% with Tim Keane.
Yep.
So you can always reach us via email if you have any questions, feedback, rants, raves, want some advice, or get some of our thoughts on the TV industry or streaming industry. You can reach us through email, and that's web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as on Facebook, facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. And on Twitter @WorldSoccerTalk. Plus, of course, you can always post comments on worldsoccertalk.com. Kartik, where can they find you on Twitter?
KKFLA737. Election heavy this week, but a healthy dose of football. And it'll obviously, once our recounts in Florida are complete, it'll shift back to being mostly soccer related.
That's good news. For me, not being very political, but that's good news. But all right, guys. Well, thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it. And Kartik, with a big weekend, you got the Manchester Derby. You've got Copa Libertadores final. You've got MLS Cup playoffs. You've got Premier League matches. You name it. What should they do?
Enjoy your football.